Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and featuring an interview recorded a couple of weeks ago with Danny Dorling. Danny Dorling is a professor of human geography at the University of Sheffield, leading the Social and Spatial Inequalities Research Group. He is also adjunct professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, and a visiting professor in the Department of Social Medicine at the University of Bristol. In 2008, Danny was appointed Honorary President of the Society of Cartographers, and in 2009, he was awarded, along with some colleagues, the Gold Award of the Geographical Association and the Back Award of the Royal Geographical Society for his work on national and international public policy. Danny was a founder of the worldmapper.org project and is a co-author of The Atlas of the Real World. His latest book, which we talk about in this interview, is Injustice, Why Social Inequality Exists.
Well, I've been joined today by Daniel Dorling, and he's here to talk about his book, Injustice, Why Social Inequality Persists. Danny, thanks for appearing on Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So let's talk about what the idea behind the book is.
The idea behind the book is basically in trying to answer that question. For most of my working life, I've been looking at the levels of social inequalities. How big are they? Are they going up and down? What are they like in Britain and what are they like in other countries? And I got quite a lot of criticism from doing that, in that people were saying, why aren't you trying to explain it rather than simply describe it? So this is my best shot at trying to explain why we have such high levels of inequality in Britain, why they vary in different countries in the world, and in a sense to begin to talk about, like many other people, about what can be done about it. I mean, I thought, to be honest, that it was just enough for me to spend a lot of my time describing these things, and I could do that role. And, I mean, I wrote a couple of books with colleagues, and they got reviews where the main criticism was yet another sort of set of maps showing how terrible the world is. And it is interesting to make yourself do something you're not comfortable with. I'm not used to writing long descriptions. I'm not used to reading half as many things I had to read for this. I much prefer doing drier things where I can say with great certainty the life expectancy in this area is this, and it has gone up or down. You know, I can give you some caveats even in a very kind of boring scientific way. This book is much less like this. There's no way in which I can be sure I'm right. This is honestly what I've come to believe.
Let's look at there's historical precedents that you're basically following. There's obviously famously the 1942 Beveridge Report, where we have the five evils: ignorance, want, idleness, squalor, and disease. And basically what you're doing in this book is coming up with new versions of those things.
Yes. That was the starting point of the book, is to say, if you were playing the game of being William Beveridge and his enormous committee, which we always forget there was many more people involved today, what would the five evils you come up with be? And many other people have done this. And in fact, the Rantry Foundation has done a public consultation asking the public what the evils they would have. What I found interesting about doing it was that what's important about the Beveridge evils is they have to be things which were largely accepted as inevitable. So in the 1930s, we did think that the poor would always be with us. We did think that most people couldn't be educated. We did think that we would always have disease. And the idea of a free health service really was just, you know, a few crazies had that idea. So I like the Beveridge Report and the original five evils because it sets you the goal of trying to come up with five things which you think are wrong, in effect evil, but which are largely accepted by people in society, particularly people running society, as a bit unfortunate but inevitable.
Okay, well let's start looking at the you rather than just those the five words that describe the five evils before, you've got basically a number of perceived wisdoms, I suppose, would be the way to describe it, about social inequality. Yeah. So we'll go through them in turn. And the first one is elitism is efficient.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, what do you mean by elitism, first of all?
I'm mainly talking about education in terms of this, and it's the idea that it's efficient to put all your eggs in a very few baskets, to select a small number of children and spend most money on those, either through private education, where Britain spends more than any other OECD country apart from Chile, and so we are unusual. And of course, the point of private education is that you have a few number of children and many teachers, through to the more expensive university education, the idea of Oxford and Cambridge as being necessary. You know, we have to have these two distinct universities and the whole hierarchy of universities, right through to the massive explosion in master's courses, which again is concentrated on, as I say, explosion, it's still a few people, and it's the people who've had got the most education to begin with who are doing the master's courses, and again on to PhDs. And at the same time, I mean, the town I grew up in, Oxford, 1 in 10 boys are still leaving school at the age of 16, 17 with no qualifications, and having as little spent on them, almost as little spent on them now as was spent on them 30 or 40 years ago.
So what's driving this, do you think? Why is that sort of system of elitism being maintained?
Well, the starting point to answer that is to realise it's strange, in that in most of the OECD, education is far less elitist. Children at the bottom end are given more attention, more time and more spending, and at the top end there's less creaming off. We tend to think of other countries as being just as elitist as we are, but when you look at the numbers and statistics, you find out that in general most people go to their local university. That's what's normal in all of the world apart from England. Mm-hmm. And you have much greater levels of social mobility and mixing, and you can learn later in life than we have. So it's something strange about England and countries that are like England. That's the beginning of where you have to look.
Let's look at a couple of the examples of elitism that you point out. And the first one of these is the historical reliance on IQ testing that's been done. I mean, how did this come about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, IQ testing, the key thing about it is this really is a story of just 100 years. I mean, these were tests which were invented, and the inventor famously said that if these were ever used to actually measure intelligence, he would wish they'd been thrown away and lost at sea. In Britain, they came about as being of mass importance as a byproduct of the Beveridge Report. The Beveridge Report wanted to bring in free secondary education for all. It was brought in quickly by the Conservatives in the 1944 Education Act, and it was great to have free secondary education for all, but they decided they needed to ration how much was being spent on different alls, and so they had the iron, the silver and the gold children. The iron children would go to secondary moderns, the gold would go to grammars, and the silver would go to techs, which almost disappeared. And an examination would be used to decide who went, and that was in effect an IQ test. And so children were shifted out at the age of 11 and had their lives sorted out from then. And other countries didn't go as far as that, although many followed. And we unravelled a lot of it in the 70s and 80s and 90s with comprehensive education. But we're now upping it again in different ways. But the IQ test became something which was normal for a large section of society. I mean, my parents know their IQ numbers. They are the numbers they were given at the age of 11 when they took the 11 plus. We wouldn't do that to a child now. It's a strange and, you know, cool and inhuman activity. But it's part of our history. And in a sense, it's still with us. I mean, we have an exam which is just as determining of your future as the 11 plus. In fact, many young people don't take it, which are A-levels. And your future is now determined at age 17 or 18 rather than age 11. And university entry is even more skewed than entry to grammar schools was.
It's also, I mean, amazing. You say your parents know their IQ numbers.
Yes.
And of course, they were their IQ numbers when they were, well, presumably 11.
Yes.
And that doesn't take into account that they could obviously change.
Oh, yes. They go up or down. But thankfully, I don't think my parents believe their numbers. I mean, the saddest thing about IQ tests is that they pick out children who are very good at doing certain tests at age 11.
Sure.
And then you have your society run largely by a set of people who are good at memorising things. So, I mean, almost all my colleagues who are older than me passed the 11 plus because they had to. I'm lucky I'm part of the first generation who went to comprehensive schools. And so I've worked with a set of very nice older men, largely men, who either went to private school or have got very good memories. But what they tended not to be so good at is imagining things or being creative in other ways. Because they were picked for being slightly nerdy in this particular way at age 10 and 11, and then put together with everybody who was like them and taken away from the rest of humanity. So we don't do it anymore, and we now do recognise that intelligence isn't like this. In that your ability to pass tests goes up and down. You can train people to do it. It's not innate. If it is innate, then you will have to have differences between men and women that are fixed. You have differences between races. I mean, and what I do in the book is bring together lots of evidence to say that this simply isn't the case.
There's one other example of elitism that I want to talk to you about, and as this is particularly relevant because this is a programme that looks at science. You talk about the Nobel Prize as being an example of elitism, so why is that?
Oh, well, I mean, it fits in the same 100-year history as IQ tests. We haven't always had Nobel Prizes. I do point out a couple of Nobel Prize winners I really like, by the way, in the book. People have suggested I do criticise them, and there's some wonderful people who've won Nobel Prizes, but the idea that everybody who wins a Nobel Prize is automatically wonderful is easily dispelled. You simply collect together the quotes of some of the more stupid things they've said, and I do that in the book, and it was fun in a way to do it. But the problem with Nobel Prizes is that they help establish the idea that there are a few superhuman people with amazing brains, the kind of Einstein figures, and then beneath them are another set of people with slightly smaller craniums who can support them, but most of you will never ever be clever enough to understand. And what we now know about intelligence and learning is that it's a shared thing. It's a thing between people, is knowledge. It's not something... We're not like little prints on another planet, and we don't learn in isolation. But the Nobel Prizes suffer from putting forward the idea of a few great people. I also look in detail at how many men and women have been awarded them, because it's one of the ways of kind of uncovering just how structural the unfairness is. Over time, only about 5% of prizes went to women. And as I was doing this, just coming to complete the book, just to really annoy me, the prize committee suddenly decided for the first time in history to award over a third of prizes in, this is 2009, October, to women.
And the first ever.
I make a great deal about how 62 economists have all been men and how inadequate they are in many ways. And then I had to quickly revise at page proofs. But it also shows how the world can change in that you can say things are impossible. There was a whole period of 15, 16 years where not a single woman was awarded a prize in any subject. And the number of prizes going to women was dropping, actually, from the 1940s onwards slowly. Things can suddenly change overnight. And it is not unconnected that the economic crash happened just before the committees decided to give out prizes to women, I don't think. Just as I think I've shown in the book that it wasn't unconnected that the fear and rise of fear against communism coincided with not giving women any prizes. It isn't direct. The committees didn't sit together and think we must give men prizes because the world has changed. But when you look at who they turned down for prizes and how they deliberated and how they gave Hemingway and Churchill and so on the literature prizes, these committees were influenced by the politics of their times. The prizes are about an ethos and about an idea about people as much as they are about the individual achievements of these particular scholars.
Well, let's move on to the next of your five received wisdoms, Ed, and this is exclusion is necessary. So let's talk about some of the ways in which people can be excluded from society.
The ways in which people are excluded nowadays from society is being excluded from social norms, what it's normal to be able to do to be a normal citizen. In Beveridge's time, the exclusion was being excluded from being able to eat a normal amount of food. And that's the old idea of poverty we have, you know, literally being on the edge of starvation and so on. Nowadays, it's very different. The key item people are excluded from is actually having a holiday. That's the marginal item. If you cannot afford to have a holiday once a year away from family or friends, you are not part of normal society. And most people think that most people should be able to have one relatively cheap holiday, particularly people with children. And this is an incredible change over that period to see it occur. And some people say, oh, this isn't poverty. You know, holidays, what are you talking about? You know, you don't need holidays. The problem comes when it becomes normal for most people to be able to have a holiday. Then suddenly there's something wrong with you if you can't.
One of the areas that you look at in this chapter is the rise of debt and the sort of debt and credit card culture. So yes. How has that changed? Because that there clearly is something that's enabled people with not very much to get something quite easily. But then, of course, they're then burdened with a massive debt.
I mean, debt's the amazing change from the 1930s and 40s, and people learned in the 30s not to get into debt. But it became increasingly necessary, particularly in the USA and the UK, from the 60s, 70s, 80s onwards. If you're in the bottom half of society, if you wanted to behave like other people, you would have to borrow money to get a car, you'd have to borrow money to do things, and most of the time you'd pay it off. But if things went wrong, you'd have problems paying it off. The almost sole reason why about a quarter of households in Britain today can't afford a holiday, particularly and more, about almost I think a third of households with children can't afford a single annual holiday, is debt. You know, if you don't have any debt, you can take out a debt and have a holiday. It's because their debts, their credit card debts, their other debts are now so high that they can't afford to spend any money on anything you might think of as a luxury. And debt levels have risen as society has become more unequal. And the other important side of debt, the side we never talk about, is of course somebody's making a lot of money out of it. When you're paying 26% on your credit card, somebody else is receiving 26% interest on lending you that money. And that's people who have so much money to spare that they can invest it in banks and other things, and their money makes money, but it's making money partly by lending other people money, and the people who lend money do better the more unequal society becomes. And this is a terrible situation to get into, and it's a situation which is extreme in Britain. I mean, the best example of this is that half of the credit card debt of Western Europe is held in the United Kingdom. So the amount of debt and the way we live our life by debt is simply not normal. The problem is that we think it's normal because we've become used to it.
There's another area that you look at, which is people might perhaps think is interesting to include under the heading of exclusion. And this is the sort of people deliberately excluding themselves. So, for instance, rich people living in gated communities.
Yes. There's been a slight increase in the number of people able to exclude themselves from the norms of society because of the amount of money they have, but not a great interest because it's very expensive. So you can never have a lot of very rich people. And the kind of ways in which people are excluded is the expensive gated home, but also regular use of both private healthcare and private education, buying luxury cars outright, these kind of behaviours which aren't normal, buying multiple properties. And when you do things like this, I mean, if you own two or three or four houses, you're going to be using up space that other people could be housed in. So your behaviour, which makes you not like normal people, and often makes people quite afraid of normal people because they don't really understand what normal people are or think of them all as poor, that kind of behaviour helps also increase the exclusion of other people.
It could be argued that something like this sort of social exclusion is something that's happening as a byproduct, sort of accidentally, rather than being in some way some sort of conspiracy, is not really the right word, but some sort of deliberate sort of government plan. But there's a very tiny, like, recent example of something like this, which I wanted to raise. Just at the end of the last government, they rushed through this digital rights bill, and this there was this idea. We've talked about this on our show quite a lot, 'cause it's one of our bugbears. And Peter Mandelson's idea was that, you know, if you were caught downloading copyrighted material, your entire household could be basically cut off from the digital economy, which is like a classic example of deliberately trying to exclude a group of people from what now is the norm.
Yeah, and the idea that you could see that as being okay behaviour, that's much more normal in an unequal country. I mean, Britain doesn't just have half the credit card debt of Western Europe. It has by far the most prisoners per head of Western Europe. We lock up the most children in Western Europe, and I'm sure if Peter Mandelson had got his way, we'd be locking up the most people for illegally downloading an interesting bit of data. One of the saddest things about what happens when you have rising inequality, it's been documented beautifully in New Zealand by Jane Kelsey and also in the States, is that it changes the nature of what is seen as acceptable behaviour in society. And so more inhuman and bad ways of behaving can begun to be seen as normal and even acceptable. So the lobbying of private industry increases in unequal societies, and they're allowed to lobby. It's even seen as part of what's good for competitiveness. And you get ridiculous arguments about how the British music industry must be protected. And, you know, arguments you just set back and say, this is silly, they're still existing, they're making a lot of money. Arguments that if you were to present it in a normal OECD country, I'm not talking about utopia here, I'm talking about countries that exist at the moment. A lot of what we do in Britain, they say, why are you British doing this? Why are you so punitive? What went wrong? But we don't see that. We just have experienced a slow and steady drift of society to a much more unequal one, whereby people at the top of society are much more closer and cozied up with private business. And a million miles away from conspiracy, just think that what private business people say is normal, and what private business people hear from their politicians who they're funding, they agree with each other. And then they say, what are these terrible people doing downloading stuff they haven't paid us for? We haven't got enough money. We may have millions already, but we need more. And so the idea of sharing things is anathema, whereas in more equal countries, the idea of sharing things is just a good way to be and a good thing to do.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Danny Dorling about his book, Injustice, Why Social Inequality Persists. So moving on, Danny, your next point of inequality is prejudice is natural.
Yes, this is the biggest change probably the most controversial one I've come up with from Beveridge. The equivalent for Beveridge was the old evil of idleness. And you might say, well, we've still got mass unemployment, why don't you keep that? But I think there's been an incredible change. The mass unemployment in the 1930s was largely middle-aged, skilled men. Younger people were employed because there was no minimum wage, they could work. The unemployment was partly caused by the economic crash, making firms poorer and unable to pay those skilled wages. For the last 20 years, we've had well over a million young people unemployed constantly since 1984 in various ways. Not because we don't have enough money to employ them, because the country's been extremely rich in that period and their wages are particularly low, but because we didn't think they were worth employing. And that's a really big change from the 30s. So we talk about NEETs, you know, not in employment, education and training, having not many skills, not being very useful and so on. These young people need to be trained, they're largely unemployable. Well, at the same time, we talk about other people at the top of the income structure being so valuable that they need many millions of pounds to get out of bed. You know, so Tony Blair, the ex-Prime Minister, how many hundreds of thousands of pounds does it take to get him to give a lecture? And you have to pay him that because he's supremely, brilliantly clever. So his words are worth so much per second. This is a prejudicial view. It's just wrong. No human being has so many pearls of wisdom that they need to be paid this much. The chief executives of companies. We could employ all a million young people under 25 who are currently out of work for just a few bankers' bonuses. That was all it would take to pay people just above the minimum wage for a year. You're talking a few hundred bankers would have to give up the extra money they get at Christmas and we could have near full employment. So it's prejudicial that we don't have full employment for people who want it now. It's no longer mass idleness caused by an economic recession as it was in the 30s. Some things have changed.
One of the things that you talk about in this section, which possibly hasn't changed from that, which was probably caused by economic movement, is the polarisation of areas of the country into places where there are, you know, the higher unemployment than others. So let's talk about why this happened.
Okay. Well, when the country was very divided in the 30s by area. So if you look at death rates by areas, we actually find the country is bimodal. There are areas with high death rates in, you know, around about Jarrow and the poor northern areas, less areas which are average and then areas which were doing better in the 30s. That changed in the 1940s, 50s, 60s and 70s. More and more areas became average. Fewer areas were very poor. So there were fewer areas with very high death rates. And then also the rich areas became poorer too. So the home counties became less exclusive by the 1970s. Then things switched around between the early and late 1970s. And the rich areas began to become richer again. The poor areas became poorer. People began to move away if they could from poor parts of cities. They put more effort into that. People began to crowd into affluent parts of cities or nice little commuter villages. The house prices went up most there. And slowly and steadily over 30 years, the country polarised geographically again.
Moving on, we're going to look at the fourth point, which is greed is good.
Yes.
So let's talk about... You give an interesting statistic, which is that a quarter of households in the UK are just getting by. So presumably that means not necessarily in poverty.
Oh, a quarter are finding it difficult. There's another large group, I think it might be even a half, who are getting by or just managing. But there's only about a third say they're living comfortably. So if you look at what households say about their positions, most of them are saying that they're just managing, just getting by, finding it difficult or finding it very difficult. And this is in one of the richest countries on earth in the richest of times, whereas if you take our average wealth and average it out, you're looking at £30,000 or £40,000 per household.
So is this because there's something that they feel they've been told they should aspire to?
Mostly, for most people, it's because they're aspiring to the average. It's been shown brilliantly by Robert Frank, who's an economist in America, a mainstream economist, who's shown that the cost of just buying an average house to live in an average area of the States has increased dramatically compared to average earnings. So you now have to put yourself in sort of purgatory to be able to do what your parents managed to do. And at the same time, if you're in the poorest quarter or tenth of areas in the US, you're now looking at a far more dangerous environment. Your children will go to schools with their metal detectors just to try and stop the weapons coming into schools. It's literally a matter of life and death in the States to try to be average. And when people say they're not managing, and they're not managing in Britain, they're just not managing to be average. It's in most cases, it's just trying to live a decent life, not trying to be particularly greedy. But one problem is that people's averages change for different people. so that if you are in the bottom of the top third of society, you think it's normal to have two holidays a year, it's normal to own your own house and perhaps have a bedroom for every child and a spare bedroom. And to be able to afford to do that stretches you. But you don't think you're being greedy because you look above you and see that somebody else has got even more space. And my favourite example of this is just looking at the super rich and feeling sorry for the people in the top 10 richest people in the country when they compare themselves to Mr. Mittal, who's the richest one, and they all don't look they're doing so well because they have far fewer billions than he has, so they can only afford one yacht each rather than two super yachts. And although this might sound trite, people really do look up to compare themselves and try not to look down. If your super rich just came down a little bit towards you, I'm not saying anyone should lose their rank position. I'm quite happy for Mr. Mittal to end up being the richest person. He could still be the richest person and be 20 billion less off. And the next one could come down and so on. It saved the country an enormous amount of money. And also everybody feels better when the gap between them is narrower.
When I was sort of mentioning the idea of people aspiring, you talk about celebrity culture in this chapter, and we'll leave that and we'll move on to the last point, because they sort of tie in, and the last point is despair is inevitable. Mm. And you talk about the rise of dissatisfaction going along with a sort of rising sort of depression and anxiety, and how those things are connected.
Yes. The trick is to realise that celebrity culture isn't just something happening to working class communities in Britain. So although working class communities might have the X Factor sent at them, middle class communities have television programmes aimed at them, telling them that they need to do well in business or they need to excel in arts or other things. But it's all about a celebrity culture all the way up and down. So the idea that you can fit in, be part of a group or a team that gets things done, is seen as less and less acceptable. You have to excel yourself. Our top banks sack in London a tenth of their staff every year with the idea they have some kind of survival of the fittest mentality. And the problem is you end up with a sort of survival of the most psychotic and willing to be abused if you sack a tenth of people every year. But it isn't the celebrity culture isn't just about poor people. It has gone right up and down British society. It affects our politicians. It affects people working in our universities. It's a kind of dragon's den mentality that's taken root, that a few people can succeed and lots of people have to fail to allow those few to succeed. And that isn't normal and it isn't necessary.
To finish off then, we could take another programme to talk about what should be done about all of these 5 points. I suppose what's interesting is you've kept mentioning how a lot of these issues are particular to at the moment the UK and the United States. Why is that? Why are there other countries? Why can we look at the Scandinavian countries or whatever, which is always the example given, and see that people are living in a better way, which we just don't seem to be able to do?
Well, you can look at almost any OECD country apart from the United States. So you have about 25 options to look at for somewhere that's doing a better job of this. The United States and United Kingdom suffer from having been the richest and most powerful countries on the planet, and that's probably, so it's not entirely our fault we're in this situation. We're still learning to live with having lost an empire, and we still behave far too much like the United States because of it, and we still keep on looking to the United States for lessons. What I try to repeatedly say in the book is that all you need do is look across to anywhere in Western Europe, or even better, Japan, which is much more of a lesson to learn, and if you want to, Scandinavia, but that's been done a lot. You can look back to our past when we were more equal. You can look to all the aspirations where hardly anybody says we hope British society can become more unequal. So both our wishes for the future, the reality in other countries, and our recent past have all been better than we currently are. And the last thing to say is inequality is incredibly expensive. Having this small group of very rich people at the top literally cost the country billions and billions. The richest 1,000 people in the last year saw their wealth rise by 77 billion in just 1 year. And that's more than the structural deficit of the country, and that's just their extra pocket money. You know, it's a silly situation to get into. The last time we were unequal was now in 1918. It crashed down, and we had economic crash, mass unemployment, and so on. My hope is that we engineer and work together on a way of reducing inequalities that isn't as violent and destructive as what occurred in the 20s and 30s. My worry is that currently we're allowing inequalities to carry on rising.
Danny, thanks for speaking to Little Adams today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Adams. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleadams.com. The Little Adams podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.